As Lord Vetinari's coach rattled off through the slush towards Gleam Street, it may have surprised its occupant to know that, in a cellar quite nearby, someone looking very much like him was chained to the wall. It was quite a long chain, giving him access to a table and chair, a bed, and a hole in the floor. Currently he was at the table. On the other side of it was Mr. Pin. Mr. Tulip was leaning menacingly against the wall. It would be clear to any experienced person that what was going on here was good cop, bad cop, with the peculiar drawback that there were no cops. There was just an apparently endless supply of Mr. Tulip. "So, Charlie," said Mr. Pin, "how about it?" "It's not illegal, is it?" said the man addressed as Charlie. Mr. Pin spread his hands. "What's legality, Charlie? Just words on paper. But you won't be doing anything wrong." Charlie nodded uncertainly. "But $10,000 doesn't sound like the kind of money you get for doing something right," he said. "Not for just saying a few words." "Mr. Tulip here once got even more money than that for saying just a few words, Charlie," said Mr. Pin soothingly.
"Yeah, I said, give me all it in cash or the girl gets it," said Mr. Tulip.
"Was that right?" said Charlie, who seemed to Mr. Pin to have a highly developed death wish. "Absolutely right for that occasion, yes," he said. "Yeah, but it's not often people make money like that," said the suicidal Charlie. His eyes kept straying to the monstrous bulk of Mr. Tulip, who was holding a paper bag in one hand and in the other hand a spoon. He was using a spoon to ferry a fine white powder to his nose, his mouth, and, once Charlie could have sworn, his ear. "Well, you are a special man, Charlie," said Mr. Pin. "And afterwards you will have to stay out of sight for a long time."
"Yeah,"
said Mr. Tulip in a spray of powder. There was a sudden strong smell of mothballs. "All right, but why did you have to kidnap me then? One minute I was locking up for the night, next minute, bang, and you've got me chained up." Mr. Pin decided to change tack. Charlie was arguing too much for a man in the same room as Mr. Tulip, especially a Mr. Tulip who was halfway through a bag of powdered mothballs. He gave him a big friendly smile. "There's no point in dwelling on the past, my friend," he said. "This is business. All we want is a few days of your time, and then you end up with a fortune, and, I believe this is important, Charlie, a lifetime in which to spend it." Charlie was turning out to be very stupid indeed. "But how do you know I won't tell someone?" he insisted. Mr. Pin sighed. "We trust you, Charlie." The man had run a clothes shop in Pseudopolis. Small shopkeepers had to be smart, didn't they? They were usually sharp as knives when it came to making just the right amount of wrong change. So much for physiognomy, thought Mr. Pin. This man could pass for the patrician even in a good light, but while by all accounts Lord Vetinari would have already worked out all the nasty ways the future could go, Charlie was actually entertaining the idea that he was going to come out of this alive and might even outsmart Mr. Pin. He was actually trying to be cunning. He was sitting a few feet away from Mr. Tulip, a man trying to snort crushed moth repellent, and he was trying guile. You almost had to admire the man. "I'll need to be back by Friday," said Charlie. "It'll all be over by Friday, will it?" The shed that was now leased by the dwarfs had, in the course of its rickety life, been a forge and a laundry and a dozen other enterprises, and had last been used as a rocking horse factory by someone who had thought something was the next big thing when it was, by then, one day away from becoming the last big flop. Stacks of half-finished rocking horses that Mr. Cheese had been unable to sell for the back rent still filled one wall all the way to the tin roof. There was a shelf of corroding paint tins. Brushes had fossilised in their jars. The press occupied the centre of the floor with several dwarfs at work. William had seen presses. The engravers used them. This one had an organic quality, though. The dwarfs spent as much time changing the press as they did using it. Extra rollers appeared. Endless belts were threaded into the works. The press grew by the hour. Good Mountain was working in front of several of the large sloped boxes, each one of which was divided into several dozen compartments. William watched the dwarf's hand fly over the little boxes of leaden letters. "Why is there a bigger box for the E's?"
'cause that's the letter we use most of.
Is that why it's in the middle of the box?
Right. E's, then T's, then A's.
I mean, people would expect to see A in the middle.
We put E.
But you've got more N's than U's, and U is a vowel.
People use more N's than you think.
On the other side of the room, Caslong's stubby dwarf fingers danced across his own boxes of letters.
You could almost read what he's working on, William began.
Goodmountain glanced up, his eyes narrowed for a moment.
Make more money in your spare time, he said. Sounds like Mr. Dibbler has been back.
William stared down at the box of letters again. Of course a quill pen potentially contained anything you wrote with it. He could understand that. But it did so in a clearly theoretical way, a safe way. Whereas these dull grey blocks looked threatening. He could understand why they worried people. Put us together in the right way, they seemed to say, and we can be anything you want. We could even be something you don't want. We can spell anything. We can certainly spell trouble. The ban on movable type wasn't exactly a law, but he knew the engravers didn't like it, because they had the world operating just as they wanted it, thank you very much. And Lord Vetinari was said not to like it, because too many words only upset people. And the wizards and the priests didn't like it, because words were important. An engraved page was an engraved page, complete and unique. But if you took the leaden letters that had previously been used to set the words of a god, and then used them to set a cookery book, what did that do to the holy wisdom? For that matter, what would it do to the pie? As for printing a book of spells, and then using the same type for a book of navigation, well, the voyage might go anywhere. On cue, because history likes neatness, he heard the sound of a carriage drawing up in the street outside. A few moments later, Lord Vetinari stepped inside and stood leaning heavily on his stick and surveying the room with mild interest. "Why, Lord de Word," he said, looking surprised. "I had no idea that you were involved in this enterprise." William coloured as he hurried over to the city's supreme ruler. "It's Mr. de Word, my lord."
"Ah, yes, of course, indeed."
Lord Vetinari's gaze traversed the inky room, paused a moment on the pile of madly smiling rocking horses, and then took in the toiling dwarfs.
"Yes, of course. And are you in charge?"
"No one is, my lord," said William. "But Mr. Goodmountain over there seems to do most of the talking."
"So what exactly is your purpose here?"
William paused, which he knew was never a good tactic with the patrician.
"Frankly, sir, it's warm, my office is freezing, and, well, it's fascinating. Look, I know it's not really—"
Lord Vetinari nodded and raised a hand.
"Be so good as to ask Mr. Goodmountain to come over here, will you?"
William tried to whisper a few instructions into Gunilla's ear as he hustled him over to the tall figure of the patrician.
"Ah, good," said the patrician.
"Now I would just like to ask one or two questions, if I may."
Goodmountain nodded.
"Firstly, is Mr. Cut-My-Own-Throat Dibbler involved in this enterprise in any significant managerial capacity?"
"What?" said William. He hadn't been expecting this.
"Shifty fellow sells sausages."
"Oh, him, no. Just the dwarfs."
"I see. And is this building built on a crack in space-time?"
"What?" said Gunilla.
The patrician sighed.
"When one has been ruler of this city as long as I have," he said, "one gets to know with a sad certainty that whenever some well-meaning soul begins a novel enterprise, they always, with some kind of uncanny foresight, sight it at the point where it will do maximum harm to the fabric of reality. There was that Holy Wood moving picture fiasco a few years ago, yes? And that music with rocks in business not long after. We never got to the bottom of that. And, of course, the wizards seem to break into the dungeon dimensions so often they might as well install a revolving door. And I'm sure I don't have to remind you what happened when the late Mr. Hong chose to open his Three Jolly Luck takeaway fish bar in Dagon Street during the lunar eclipse. Yes? You see, gentlemen, it would be nice to think that someone, somewhere in this city, is engaged in some simple enterprise that he's not going to end up causing tentacled monsters and dread apparitions to stalk the streets, eating people. So?
What?
Said Goodmountain. We haven't noticed any cracks, said William.
Ah, but possibly on this very site a strange cult once engaged in eldritch rites, the very essence of which permeated the neighbourhood, and which seeks only the right circumstances to once again arise and walk around eating people.
What?
Said Gunilla. He looked helplessly at William, who could only add, They made rocking horses here.
Really? I've always thought there was something slightly sinister about rocking horses, said Lord Vetinari. But he looked subtly disappointed. Then he brightened up. He pointed to the big stone on which the type was arranged.
Aha, he said. Innocently taken from the overgrown ruins of a megalithic stone circle, this stone is redolent with the blood of thousands, I have no doubt, who will emerge to seek revenge, you may depend upon it.
It was cut especially for me by my brother, said Gunilla. And I don't have to take that kind of talk, mister. Who do you think you are coming in here and talking daft like that?
William stepped forward at a healthy fraction of the speed of terror.
I wonder if I might just take Mr. Goodmountain aside and explain one or two things to him? He said quickly.
The patrician's bright, inquiring smile did not so much as flicker.
What a good idea, he said, as William frog-marched the dwarf into a corner. He'll be sure to thank you for it later.
Lord Vetinari stood leaning on his stick and looking at the press with an air of benevolent interest, while behind him William de Worde explained the political realities of Ankh-Morpork, especially those relating to sudden death, with gestures. After 30 seconds of this, Goodmountain came back and stood four square in front of the patrician with his thumbs in his belt.
"I speak as I find me," he said. "Always have done, always will."
"And what is it that you call a spade?" said Lord Vetinari.
"What? Never use spades," said the glowering dwarf. "Farmers use spades, but I call a shovel a shovel."
"Yes, I thought you would," said Lord Vetinari.
"Young William here says you're a ruthless despot who doesn't like printing. But I say you're a fair-minded man who won't stand in the way of an honest dwarf making a bit of a living, am I right?"
Once again, Lord Vetinari's smile remained in place.
"Mr. de Worde, a moment, please."
The patrician put his arm companionably round William's shoulders and walked him gently away from the watching dwarfs.
"I only said that some people call you—" William began.
"Now, sir," said the patrician, waving this away, "I think I might just be persuaded, against all experience, that we have here a little endeavour that might just be pursued without filling my streets with inconvenient occult rubbish. It is hard to imagine such a thing in Ankh-Morpork, but I could just about accept it as a possibility. And it so happens that I feel the question of printing is one that might, with care, be reopened."
"You do?"
"Yes. So I am minded to allow your friends to proceed with their folly."
They're not exactly—" William began.
"Of course, I should add that, in the event of there being any problems of a tentacular nature, you would be held personally responsible."
"Me? But I—"
"Ah, you feel that I am being unfair. Ruthlessly despotic, perhaps.
Well, I—"
"Apart from anything else, the dwarfs are a very hard-working and valuable ethnic grouping in the city," said the patrician. "On the whole, I wish to avoid any low-level difficulties at this time, what with the unsettled situation in Uberwald and the whole Muntab question."
"Where's Muntab?" said William.
"Exactly. How is Lord de Worde, by the way? You should write to him more often, you know." William said nothing. "I always think it is a very sad thing when families fall out," said Lord Vetinari. "There is far too much mutton-headed ill-feeling in the world." He gave William a companionable pat. "I'm sure you will see to it that the printing enterprise stays firmly in the realms of the cult, the canny, and the scrutable. Do I make myself clear?"
"But I don't have any control of—"
"Yes, Lord Vetinari," said William.
"Good, good."
The patrician straightened up. turned and beamed at the dwarfs. "Jolly good," he said. "My word. Lots of little letters, all screwed together. Possibly an idea whose time has come. I may even have an occasional job for you myself." William waved frantically at Gunilla from behind the patrician's back. "Special rate for government jobs," the dwarf muttered. "Oh, but I wouldn't dream of paying any less than other customers," said the patrician.
"I wasn't going to charge you less than—"
"Well, I'm sure we've all been very pleased to see you here, Your Lordship," said William brightly, swivelling the patrician in the direction of the door. "We look forward to the pleasure of your custom."
"Are you quite sure Mr. Dibbler isn't involved in this concern?"
"I think he's having some things printed, but that's all," said William.
"Astonishing, astonishing," said Lord Vetinari, getting into his coach. "I do hope he isn't ill."
Two figures watched his departure from the rooftop opposite. One of them said, very, very quietly. The other said,
"You have a point of view, Mr. Tulip."
"And he's the man who runs the city?"
"Yeah."
"So where's his bodyguards?
"If we wanted to scrag him, here and now, how useful would, say, 4 bodyguards be?"
"As a chocolate kettle, Mr. Pin."
"There you are, then."
"But I could knock him over from here with a brick."
"I gather there are many organisations who hold views on that, Mr. Tulip. People tell me this dump is thriving. The man at the top has a lot of friends when everything is going well. You would soon run out of bricks."
Mr. Tulip looked down at the departing coach.
"From what I hear, he mostly doesn't do a thing," he complained.
"Yeah," said Mr. Pin smoothly. "One of the hardest things to do properly in politics." Mr. Tulip and Mr. Pin brought different things to their partnership, and in this instance, what Mr. Pin brought was political savvy. Mr. Tulip respected this, even if he didn't understand it. He contented himself with muttering,
"It'd be simpler to kill him."
"Oh, for a simple world," said Mr. Pin. "Look, lay off the honk, eh? That stuff's for trolls. It's worse than slab, and they cut it with ground glass."
"It's chemical,"
said Mr. Tulip, sullenly.
Mr. Pin sighed. "Shall I try again?" he said. "Listen carefully. Drugs equals chemicals, but—" and please do listen to this part. "Sheesh. Chemicals do not equal drugs. Remember all that trouble with the calcium carbonate when you paid the man $5?
"Made me feel good," muttered Mr. Tulip.
"Calcium carbonate," said Mr. Pin. "Even for you, I mean. Look, you put up your actual nose enough chalk that someone could probably cut your head off and write on a blackboard with your neck." That was the major problem with Mr. Tulip, he thought, as they made their way to the ground. It wasn't that he had a drugs habit. He wanted to have a drugs habit. What he had was a stupidity habit, which cut in whenever he found anything being sold in little bags. And this had resulted in Mr. Tulip seeking heaven in flour, salt, baking powder, and pickled beef sandwiches. In a street where furtive people were selling clang, slip, chop, rhino, skunk, triplin, floats, honk, double honk, gongers, and slack, Mr. Tulip had an unerring way of finding the man who was retailing curry powder at what worked out as $600 a pound. It was so embarrassing. Currently, he was experimenting with the whole range of recreational chemicals available to Ankh-Morpork's troll population, because at least when dealing with trolls, Mr. Tulip had a moderate chance of outsmarting somebody. In theory, slab and honk shouldn't have any effect on the human brain, apart from maybe dissolving it. Mr. Tulip was hanging in there. He'd tried normality once and hadn't liked it. Mr. Pin sighed again. "Come on," he said. "Let's feed the geek." In Ankh-Morpork, it is very hard to watch without being watched in turn, and the two furtive watchers were indeed under careful observation. They were being watched by a small dog, variously coloured but mainly a rusty grey, Occasionally it scratched itself, with a noise like someone trying to shave a wire brush. There was a piece of string around its neck. This was attached to another piece of string, or rather, to a length made up of pieces of string inexpertly knotted together. The string was being held in the hand of a man. At least, such might be deduced from the fact that it disappeared into the same pocket of the grubby coat as one's sleeve, which presumably had an arm in it, and theoretically, therefore, a hand on the end. It was a strange coat. It stretched from the pavement almost to the brim of the hat above it, which was shaped rather like a sugar loaf. There was a suggestion of grey hair around the join. One arm burrowed in the suspicious depths of a pocket and produced a cold sausage.
"Two men spying on a patrician," said the dog. "An interesting thing."
"Bagram,"
said the man, and broke the sausage into two democratic halves. William wrote a short paragraph about Patrician visits the bucket and examined his notebook. Amazing, really. He'd found no less than a dozen items for his newsletter in only a day. It was astonishing what people would tell you if you asked them. Someone had stolen one of the golden fangs of the statue of Offler the crocodile god. He'd promised Sergeant Colon a drink for telling him that, but in any case had got some way towards payment by appending to his paragraph the sentence, "The watch are mightily in pursuit of the wrongdoer and are confident of apprehension at an early juncture." He was not entirely sure about this, although Sergeant Colon had looked very sincere when he said it. The nature of truth always bothered William. He had been brought up to tell it, or more correctly, to own up, and some habits are hard to break if they've been beaten in hard enough. And Lord de Worde had inclined to the old proverb that, as you bend the twig, so grows the tree. William had not been a particularly flexible twig. Lord de Worde had not himself been a violent man. He'd merely employed them. Lord de Worde, as far as William could recall, had no great enthusiasm for anything that involved touching people. Anyway, William always told himself, he was no good at making things up. Anything that wasn't the truth simply unravelled for him. Even little white lies like, "I shall definitely have the money by the end of the week," always ended in trouble. That was telling stories. A sin in the de Worde compendium that was worse than lying. It was trying to make lies interesting. So William de Worde told the truth, out of cosmic self-defence. He'd found a hard truth less hard than an easy lie. There had been rather a good fight in the mended drum. William was very pleased with that one. Whereupon Breezok the Barbarian picked up a table and delivered a blow to Moulton the Snatcher, who in his turn seized hold of the chandeliers and swung thereon, the while crying, "Take that, thou B.ST.RD, that you are." At which juncture a ruckus commenced and five or six people were hurt. He took it all down to the bucket. Gunilla read it with interest. It seemed to take very little time for the dwarfs to set it up in type. And it was odd, but once it was in type, all the letters so neat and regular, it looked more real. Bodney, who seemed to be second in command of the print room, squinted at the columns of type over Good Mountain shoulders.
"Hmm,"
he said. "What do you think?" said William.
"It looks a bit grey," said the dwarf. "All the type bunched up. Looks like a book."
"Well, that's all right, isn't it?" said William. Looking like a book sounded like a good thing.
"Maybe you want to get it more sort of spaced out," said Gunilla.
William stared at the printed page. An idea crept over him. It seemed to evolve from the page itself. "How about," he said, "if we put a little title on each piece?" He picked up a scrap of paper and doodled, "5/6, hurt in tavern brawl." Bodney read it solemnly.
"Yes," he said eventually, "that looks suitable."
He passed the paper across the table.
"What do you call this news sheet?" he said.
"I don't," said William.
"But you've got to call it something," said Bodney. "What do you put at the top?"
"Generally something like, 'To my lord the—'" William began. Bodney shook his head.
"You can't put that," he said. "You want something a bit more general, more snappy."
"How about Ankh-Morpork items?" said William. "Sorry, but I'm not much good at names." Gunilla pulled his little hod out of his apron and selected some letters from one of the cases on the table. He screwed them together, inked them, and rolled a sheet of paper over them. William read, "Ankh, Morpork, Times."
"Messed that up a bit. Wasn't paying attention," muttered Gunilla, reaching for the type.
William stopped him. "I don't know," he said. "Leave it as it is. Just make it a bigger T and a smaller I."
"That's it, then," said Gunilla. "All done. All right, Dad? How many copies do you want?"
20? 30?
"How about a couple of 100?
Gunilla nodded at the dwarfs who set to work.
"It's hardly worth going to press for less."
"Good grief! I can't imagine there's enough people in the city that'd pay $5.
"All right. Charge them half a dollar. Then it'll be $50 for us, and the same for you."
"My word, really?" William stared at the beaming dwarf. "But I've still got to sell them," he said. "It's not as though they're cakes in a shop. It's not like..." He sniffed. His eyes began to water. "Oh, dear," he said. "We're going to have another visitor. I know that smell."
"What smell?" said the dwarf.
The door creaked open. There was this to be said about the smell of foul old Ron, an odour so intense that it took on a personality of its own and fully justified the capital letter. After the initial shock, the organs of smell just gave up and shut down, as if no more able to comprehend the thing than an oyster can comprehend the ocean. After some minutes in its presence, wax would trickle out of people's ears and their hair would begin to bleach. It had developed to such a degree that it now led a semi-independent life of its own and often went to the theatre by itself or read small volumes of poetry. Ron was outclassed by his smell. Foul old Ron's hands were thrust deeply into his pockets, but from one pocket issued a length of string, or rather a great many lengths of string tied together into one length. The other end was attached to a small dog of the greyish persuasion. It was possibly a terrier. It walked with a limp, and also in a kind of oblique fashion, as though it was trying to insinuate its way through the world. It walked like a dog who has long ago learned that the world contains more thrown boots than meaty bones. It walked like a dog that was prepared at any moment to run. It looked up at William with crusted eyes and said, "Woof!" William felt he ought to stand up for mankind. "Sorry about the smell," he said. Then he stared at the dog.
"What's this smell you keep going on about?" said Gunilla.
The rivets on his helmet were beginning to tarnish.
"It belongs to Mr. Ron," said William, still giving the dog a suspicious look. "People say it's glandular."
He was sure he'd seen the dog before. It was always in the corner of the picture, as it were, ambling through the streets or just sitting on a corner watching the world go by.
"What does he want?" said Gunilla. "Do you think he wants us to print something?"
"Shouldn't think so," said William. "He's a sort of beggar, only they won't let him in the Beggar's Guild any more."
"He isn't saying anything."
"Well, usually he just stands there until people give him something to go away. You've heard of things like the welcome wagon, where various neighbours and traders greet newcomers to an area?"
"Yes."
"Well, this is the dark side." Foul old Ron nodded and held out a hand.
"That's right, Mr. Push. Don't try the blarney gobble on me, Juggins. I told them I ain't slanging the gentry, bugger it. Millennium and shrimp, dang."
"A woof."
William glared at the dog again.
"Growl," it said.
Gunilla scratched somewhere in the recesses of his beard.
"One thing I already noticed about this here town," he said, "is that people'll buy practically anything off a man in the street."
He picked up a handful of the news sheets, still damp from the press.
"Can you understand me, mister?" he said. "Bagger it."
Gunilla nudged William in the ribs.
"Does that mean yes or no, do you think?"
"Probably yes."
"Okay. Well, see here now. If you sell these things at, 20 pence each, you can keep..."
"Hey, you can't sell it that cheap," said William.
"Why not?"
"Why? Because, well, anyone will be able to read it, that's why."
"Good, because that means anyone will be able to pay 20 pence, said Gunilla calmly. "There's lots more poor folk than rich folk, and it's easier to get money out of them."
He grimaced at foul old Ron.
"This may seem a strange question," he said, "but have you got any friends?"
I told him, bugger him."
"Probably yes," said William. "He hangs out with a bunch of, unfortunates who live under one of the bridges. Well, not exactly hangs out, more droops."
"Well, now," said Gunilla, waving the copy of the Times at Ron,
You can tell them that if they can sell these to people for 20 pence each, I'll let you keep one nice shiny penny.
Yeah, and you can put your nice shiny penny where the sun don't shine, said Ron.
Oh, so you... Gunther began.
William laid a hand on his arm.
Sorry, just a minute. What was that you said, Ron? He said.
Bugger it,
said foul old Ron.
It had sounded like Ron's voice, and it had seemed to come from the general area of Ron's face. It was just that it had demonstrated a coherence you didn't often get.
You want more than a penny? Said William carefully.
Got to be worth 5 pence a time, said Ron,
more or less. For some reason, William's gaze was dragged down to the small grey dog. It returned it amiably and said, Woof! He looked back up again.
Are you all right, foul old Ron? He said. Got the gear, said Ron, mysteriously.
All right, 2 pence, said Gunilla.
4, Ron seemed to say. But let's not mess about, okay? $1 per 30.
It's a deal, said Good Mountain,
who spat in his hand and would have held it out to seal the contract if William hadn't gripped it urgently.
Don't!
What's wrong?
William sighed. Have you got any horribly disfiguring diseases?
No.
Do you want some?
Oh.
Gunilla lowered his hand.
You tell your friends to get round here right now, okay?
He said. He turned to William.
Trustworthy, are they?
Well, sort of, said William. It's probably not a good idea to leave paint thinners around.
Outside, foul old Ron and his dog ambled down the street, and the strange thing was that a conversation was going on, even though there was technically only one person there.
See? I told you. You just let me do the talking, all right?
Bugger it.
Right. You stick with me, and you won't go far wrong.
Bugger it.
Really? Well, I suppose that'll have to do. Bark, bark.